Is everybody okay? Does it need to be a little cooler in here?
Always.
Chapter 20 of the book of Job. Where we are at. See, the title of the message is Zophar's Final Address. Or at least after Job's response to Zophar, which is just one chapter, we'll have finished the second round of debates. You'll remember first Eliphaz spoke first, Job replied, then Bildad spoke, Job replied, then Zophar spoke, Job replied. Then they went through that process again, Eliphaz, then Job, Bildad, then Job. And now, this morning, chapter 20, we're at Zophar for the second time through, and Job will respond. That will conclude the second round. But the third round, you don't hear from Zophar. So this is the last time, as far as I know of, that we will encounter Zophar by name, or even by him directly saying something in the book of Job. So, this is it for Zophar. You'll notice within the next two or three weeks, there's going to be a change in sort of how the dialogues are as we go through the book of Job. So far, it's been like I've just said, like you've been hearing for the last 10 or 12 weeks. But very soon, Job's going to give a lengthy address, and then there's going to be a new guy on the scene, Elihu. And we'll hear from Elihu, then we'll hear from Job again, and then we'll hear from God. And God gets his say in as well. So things are going to kind of be shifting a little bit, so kind of be, stay tuned for that. But this morning, we're going to look at Zophar. Now, Zophar, as far as I can see, has a good message. Zophar, the things that he says about the wicked, the things that he says about the end result of the wicked, the things that he says about God's judgment, God's wrath, God's anger against evil, I don't really find a lot wrong with that. All right, the problem comes with the implications. Because as we read this chapter, and you know the context of who is there and what's going on, and it's hard, it's almost impossible not to listen to Zophar speak and think he's pointing a finger right at Job. You ever sat in a church service, maybe even here, and listen to John or me and think, man, he's talking right at me. He's been reading my mail or whatever. You know, very often that's not the case. The proverb says the wicked flee when no man pursues them. And that's more likely to be the scenario, I would imagine. But let's look at what Zophar has to say, and then we'll look at four or five things about it. So let's read our chapter, starting in chapter 20, verse 1. Then Zophar, the Naamathite. Y'all know any Naamathites? Zophar? Oh, that was good. That was good, Stephen. Zophar is the only one you know. Then Zophar the Naamathite replied, "My troubled thoughts prompt me to answer because I am greatly disturbed. I hear a rebuke that dishonors me, and my understanding inspires me to reply. Surely you know how it has been from of old, ever since man was placed on the earth, that the mirth of the wicked is brief, the joy of the godless lasts but a moment. Though his pride reaches to the heavens and his head touches the clouds, he will perish forever like his own dung. Those who have seen him will say, "Where is he?" Like a dream he flies away, no more to be found, banished like a vision of the night. The eye that saw him will not see him again. His place will look on him no more. His children must make amends to the poor. His own hands must give back his wealth. The youthful vigor that fills his bones will lie with him in the dust. Though evil is sweet in his mouth, and he hides it under his tongue, though he cannot bear to let it go and keeps it in his mouth, yet his food will turn sour in his stomach. It will become the venom of serpents within him. He will spit out the riches he swallowed. God will make his stomach vomit them up. He will suck the poison of serpents. The fangs of an adder will kill him. He will not enjoy the streams, the rivers flowing with honey and cream. What he toiled for, he must give back uneaten. He will not enjoy the profit from his trading, for he has oppressed the poor and left them destitute. He has seized houses he did not build. Surely he will have no respite from his craving. He cannot save himself by his treasure. Nothing is left for him to devour. His prosperity will not endure. In the midst of his plenty, distress will overtake him. The full force of misery will come upon him. When he has filled his belly, God will vent his burning anger against him and rain down his blows upon him. Though he flees from an iron weapon, a bronze-tipped arrow pierces him. He pulls it out of his back, the gleaming point out of his liver. Terrors will come over him. Total darkness lies in wait for his treasures. A fire unfanned will consume him and devour what is left in his tent. The heavens will expose his guilt. The earth will rise up against him. A flood will carry off his house, rushing waters on the day of God's wrath. Such is the fate God allots the wicked, the heritage appointed for them by God. Very descriptive chapter. We've had a few chapters, one in particular I call word pictures. This could be another one of those. It's hard not to see images in your mind that are described by the words of Zophar here. You see 4 points on the outline. The first one is a little different, and then we'll get into the rest. But the first point is this: it is not always necessary to have the last word. Now, I don't know. I'm not very good at doing that. And I don't know very many people who are. But sometimes when we get in debates, especially the more heated they are, the more intense they are, it's hard to just let it go, isn't it? It's hard to just drop it. Now, that's not, it doesn't always have to be bad. One thing I've noticed with the proliferation of social media is that as a culture, we have had to learn new manners. New manners that apply to social media. I remember a number of years ago when there was a chat room, fire something. What was that? Fire talk? Was it fire talk? Fire what? Fire talk? Okay, this was, Kenny, this is probably before you was born. Okay, fire talk. And John was on there, Jim Benkert. Y'all know Jim. Most of you know Jim. He was on fire talk. And he talked me into getting on fire talk. And you'd have to know my relationship with Jim. Jim worked with me, and we were always bantering to each other, you know, and insulting one another and talking, you know, just joking to one another. Well, I get on Fire Talk, and Jim's, you know, find where Jim's at. I know where he tells me where he's at, and I finally find him on there. And there's this room, and somebody's moderating the room. Well, I hadn't been on there 30 seconds, and Jim said something, and I kind of smarted off to him like I would have if he'd been sitting across the table from me. And next thing I knew, I'm gone. You know, I was just joking. Jim knew I was joking, but the other 20 or so people listening didn't, and the moderator thought I was an arrogant snob or whatever and booted me out. I don't know how many times over the last few years, and it's, I don't think it's getting any better. It's just different media things that come along, but it started out in emails. People, you know, you could say something in an email and hit that send button and send it, and the person who gets it, they can't see you say it. They don't know your expression. They don't know your motive. They don't know your intent. All they're reading are the words. And I don't know how many times I've heard of people getting bent out of shape over an email that was sent to them harmlessly. No intent to it at all, okay? And now you multiply that by, you know, all the other things. Facebook probably would be the biggest, you know. People put all their woes is me on there and tell their life story and tell all the horrible things that's going on in their life and how rough it is or how wonderful it is, and paints an inaccurate picture of their life. And Susan, and I'll be going down the road, and this is not a bad thing about Susan. We joke about it occasionally. She'll be texting, probably one of y'all. And I joke with her about who's going to get the last word. And they'll be, you know, okay, I'll see you tomorrow. Okay. And then that person has to say, okay. Roger. See you later. I said, can you let them have the last word this time, you know? Just stop. But we're afraid if we do, how's it feel? How are they gonna feel? They didn't answer my text. All right? Zophar, notice what Zophar says here. My troubled thoughts prompt me to answer. Zophar feels like inside him he's got to respond. My thought to that is, so what? So what how I feel inside? That doesn't mean I've got to open my mouth and say something just because I feel like I need to. But you know, we hear this debate, and in the context of here, they're trying to help Job see that his problems he brought upon himself because he's wicked. Job says, no, I'm not. So here's this debate back and forth. And Zophar says, inside me I'm compelled to respond. Now here's how sometimes I feel. And I know some of you feel the same way because we've had this discussion and you've told me the same thing. I'll be discussing something and in our context, it will be a theological issue, a doctrinal issue, a moral issue, something of importance. And we're at disagreement. Or I may not even be part of the conversation. I'm just listening to two other people discuss. And I feel like if I don't say something, that they're going to think I agree with them. And I sure don't want that. If I don't respond, and give my point of view, they're going to think that it's not that important what you say or believe or whatever, and I sure don't want that. If I don't set them straight, God is going to be defamed, as if God needs me to defend him to the universe. Sometimes it's okay just to let it go, just to let people spout their piece, as wrong as they are, and just let it go. I'm not good at doing that. Most people aren't. Zophar wasn't either. Zophar justified his speaking out by this inner compelling thoughts and troubles, that something that was troubling him inside. And sometimes we do that. We say, we don't maybe not say it that way, but we'd say, I felt God was wanting me to say something. I felt the Holy Spirit leading me to say something. Now, just because someone says that, I don't always buy it. Because a lot of times what comes out their mouth, I have my doubts as to whether the Holy Spirit was leading them to say that or not. But just the fact that they say it is supposed to make it right. It's supposed to make it okay. Anytime you feel like God's wanting you to say something, pause and think. Pause and say, is this really God wanting me to say this, or is this just me? Anyway, that's where Zophar is. Zophar has been rebuked, and he's going to answer. Zophar, Job has rebuked not just Zophar, but Eliphaz and Bildad too. Job has said something against them, and Zophar is going to answer. And answer he does. Point number two. The wicked man's fame and fortune is fleeting. Now, Zophar is going to give us some general principles that, as far as I can tell, I buy into them. I agree with him. In the great scheme of things, the wicked man's fame is fleeting. It is short-lived. In the grand scheme of things, the wicked man's fortune, no matter how great it is short-lived. It is fleeting. Now let's read our verses 4 to 11, and see what they say, just one verse at a time. Verse 4, he says, surely you know, Zophar says, Job, surely you know, How it has been from of old. As long as the earth has been around, as long as there has been time, here's the way it has been. Ever since man was placed on the earth, here's how it's been. The mirth, or the joy, the pleasure, the happiness of the wicked is brief. The joy of the godless lasts but a moment. So Zophar tells Job this. As long as the earth has been, Job, the wicked, their pleasure, their day in the sun is very short-lived. Now, put in perspective, or perhaps context, all of us could name perhaps a wicked person who seemed to enjoy his pleasure, seemed to enjoy his evil and his godlessness for a considerable period of time. But I doubt if any of us could find one example in the last 200 years of a person on this earth that has enjoyed his pleasure to the full extent for more than 50 years. In the grand scheme of things, 50 years is a blink of the eye. If this guy is my next door neighbor, it might seem like a long time. But in the final analysis, our lives are short. So the amount of wickedness that we can participate in is even shorter. But it's rare that a person who takes great joy and pride in living a wicked life does it for that long. Most of them die young. Okay, not all. The human body is very adept with enduring stupid things that we put into it or the way that we treat it. It's amazing to me sometimes to see some of these old rock star guys or whatever they were that consumed drug after drug after drug, and you look at them now and they're 60 but they look 90, but I'm surprised they're even still alive. So far it says, Job, this is the way it is. The pleasure of the wicked is short-lived. Verse 6, notice what he says. Though his pride reaches to the heavens and his head touches the clouds. It doesn't matter how high and mighty he is. It doesn't matter how much he's got. It doesn't matter how important it is, how much power he has. It doesn't matter how much influence that he has. He says in verse 6, verse 7, he says, he will perish forever. It's short-lived. It doesn't matter how much power he has. He cannot keep it from happening. He says he will perish forever like his own dung. And those who have seen him, those who knew him, someday will say, where is he? Where is he? You could think of situations where that has happened, where there's been someone in the community or someone that you knew who seemed like they were up and coming, seemed like they were going to be an important person. And next thing you know, you turn around and say, you know, for the last 5 years or 10 years, I haven't heard about this person. You know, where is he at? What happened to so-and-so? Okay, he's gone. In the building trade, you know, I've been building around here. My dad was a builder here before me, and we moved here in 1970, so I've been around the construction in this area since 1970. I've seen a lot of guys come and go. And some of them come quickly and blow up real big, make a big scene, big name for themselves on the scene, or it looks like they're going to, and then just as quickly, they're gone. It's that way in a lot of things in life. Notice what he says in verse 8. Like a dream, he flies away. No more to be found, banished like a vision in the night. The eye that saw him will not see him again. His place will look on him no more. Now verse 10 is a little different. We'll see this same idea a little later on. It says, his children must make amends to the poor. His own hands must give back his wealth. Now there's an underlying idea here that puts this thought into your head that this man's wealth was taken at someone else's expense. And now he's having to give an account for it. And he is gone. The earth has swallowed him up. He was here and now he's gone. But yet whatever he had left, the debts, all of the cheating and whatever it was that he did, fell upon his children. And now his children must satisfy the poor people that this man mistreated. Now this is Zophar speaking, Zophar giving this out. And it brought the thought to me that what I've got written down here, the entitlement mentality, is not new after all. All right? Barack Obama didn't come up with that idea. It's been around a long time. Just because someone succeeds, someone is successful, someone is wealthy, there are always going to be people that think he cheated someone. He must have gotten it in a dishonest manner some way, or he wouldn't have this. The wicked man's fame and fortune is fleeting. Number three, the wicked man's pleasure turns to poison. Let's read verses 12 to 19. It says, though evil is sweet in his mouth and he hides it under his tongue, though he cannot bear to let it go and keeps it in his mouth. Now here, Zophar is giving a word picture of eating something that is pleasurable to you. Now all of us probably have favorite foods that we like and we enjoy eating them and they taste good, and so we usually end up eating, you know, a little more than we would if it didn't taste good, right? We eat enough. We often eat too much. And what the picture that Zophar is painting here is not that the person has eaten too much. It's not that his stomach hurts because he ate too much. It's that what he did eat, he enjoyed it, it was pleasurable to him, but suddenly it has turned to poison. It is poisoning him. He says, yet his food was sour, verse 14, it was sour in his stomach. It will become the venom of serpents within him. Notice how many times in these verses he uses the analogy of a snake, a poisonous snake. He will spit out the riches he swallowed. God will make his stomach vomit them up. He will suck the poison of serpents. The fangs of an adder will kill him. Verse 17 is a kind of one of those verses you look at, pick out the verse that doesn't belong. This would be verse 17. He will not enjoy the streams, the rivers flowing with honey and cream. Now, why that is in there, what the connection is, ask somebody smarter than me. But it leaves me with the thought that Zophar is saying not only will he be poisoned, all the things that he takes in, the pleasurable things, will turn against him and end up poisoning him, but he will not enjoy these things. He will not enjoy the rivers that are flowing with honey and cream. He will not enjoy, you know, the landscape. He will not enjoy the beautiful sights. I can identify with it in that way because that's what I like to see. I would like to have a house sitting on the banks of a creek and just listen to the water flow over the shoals every day. Maybe that's what he's saying. He would not be able to enjoy those things. And then he comes back again. Comes back again to this idea. Why is it that the pleasurable things he eats will turn sour like a poison, the poison of an asp? Why is it that that happens? Verse 19, because, Zophar says, he has oppressed the poor and left them desolate. He has seized houses he did not build. Does that remind you of anything the last few years? Job, you have a house. You did not build that house. I remember that. A little different context, but Job was not successful because of what Job did, according to Zophar. Job was successful because he's riding on the backs of somebody else. All right, when we read this, it's almost impossible to read this and not think that Zophar is pointing his finger at Job, isn't it? Job, you were wealthy, you were rich, and it's gone. Just like we always heard, riches are fleeting. They're there for a moment. It's been applied to everyone in our lives throughout history, and now it's hitting home to you. The wicked are pleasurable and the wicked have pleasure, the wicked are have possessions just for a short period of time. Job, Zophar seems to be saying, you had all these riches, and apparently you had them because you took advantage of the poor. You took things away from them. You were able, because of your money, because of your position, to take advantage of people and seize their even their homes that you did not need. You did not have to have it, but you took advantage of the situation. So that's 12 through 19. Then we get to the last point, and that's this. God's appointments never need rescheduling. God's appointments never need rescheduling. As you read verses 20 to 29, it left me with a picture of a guy, of a man, or someone, whoever he's talking about here, that is being just forced through life. He is not able to act upon his situation. He's not even able to react. He is just being driven like a strong current in a rushing stream, and it carries him wherever it is he wants to go. And any resistance that he may try to put up is futile. It's doing absolutely no good. Now notice the phrases, some of the phrases we read through here. It says, surely he will have no respite from his craving. No respite. There's no rest. There's no break in his troubles. There's not a moment to catch his breath. All the bad things that are coming upon him, the judgments that are falling upon him, he says there's no respite for those things. It's a constant thing. The last half of that verse, he cannot save himself by his treasure. He can't buy his way out of this trouble. He doesn't have enough money. He doesn't have any because it's been destroyed. But even if he did, he does not have enough treasure to buy his way to make all this trouble to stop. Nothing is left for him to devour. His prosperity will not endure. There is nothing left for him to devour in the sense that there's nothing left that he can satisfy this craving that he has to possess things, to get things, to bring more pleasure to him. He cannot continue that lifestyle. It's interesting how a person's lifestyle, especially if they have a lot of money and they spend a lot of money, how much it costs to maintain that lifestyle. I don't know how many of you have been to Biltmore Estates over in wherever that's at? Asheville, North Carolina. Beautiful place. I could have stayed there 2 or 3 days just looking and seeing and imagining how they built all of this stuff. But you know, that estate, and we talked to, you know, some of the guides and stuff around there, became almost a curse for the family that it was left to, because it cost so much just to keep it up. Someone built a multi-million dollar estate and mansion, and it takes millions of dollars to keep that thing going. That's kind of what Zophar is saying here. There's nothing left for him to devour. He has a rich lifestyle, and he is accustomed to nice things. He's accustomed to doing this and doing that and eating this and eating that and going here and going there. And suddenly when it is cut off, it's kind of like a culture shock. You know, you can't maintain that. He goes on and says, in the midst of his plenty, distress will overtake him. As if something overtakes you, you're trying to avoid it. You're trying to outrun it. You're trying to escape, but it overtakes you. The full force of misery will come upon him. Not just misery will come upon him, but the full force of misery will come upon him. When he has filled his belly, God will vent God's burning anger against him. And God will rain down God's blows upon him. Verse 24, though he flees from an iron weapon, a bronze-tipped arrow pierces him. The analogy there is he may escape the big weapons, but even a smaller one still gets him. He escapes the iron, but the bronze gets him. It pierces him. He says he pulls it out of his back, the gleaming point out of his gall or his liver. Terrors will come over him. Verse 26, total darkness lies in wait for his treasures. Now notice the next phrase. A fire unfanned will consume him and devour what is left in his tent. A fire unfanned. What is the significance of a fire unfanned consuming you and devouring what is left? What's different than a fire unfanned and a fanned fire? That's the only thing I could think of. A fire that has a strong wind behind it, it may be tall and big, but it comes and it's gone. But a fire unfanned is here. It's got a deep bed of red hot coals. And it sits there and it burns and it burns and it burns. That's the only thing I could think of. A fire unfanned will consume him. It's not just blowing through in a few hours. It is there and continues to burn and consume, devour what is left. The heavens, verse 27, will expose his guilt. The earth will rise up against him. Analogy of everything. It's not just those around me who speak evil of me. The heavens, the whole universe exposes this wicked man for what he is. The earth rises up against him. And in verse 28, he changes the analogy to a flood, to waters, destroying waters. A flood will carry off his house, rushing waters on the day of what? God's wrath. Again, he brings it back to where this punishment is coming from. Then it closes with verse 29. Such is the fate God allots the wicked, the heritage appointed for them by God. Zophar says, Job, the wicked, their day in the sun is short. It is over. God appoints them their judgment, and this is what they will inherit. This is what their children, their family will inherit. It's a heritage appointed to them by God. It doesn't matter how much he tries to escape it. It doesn't matter how much he tries to avoid it. It doesn't matter how much he tries to buy it off. Can't be done. There is no escaping God's appointed judgment. And Zophar says this, like I said before, Zophar gives this speech. It is very graphic. It is very full of imagery. And it's hard not for Job, I'm sure for Job to sit there and not think, he's pointing at me. He's preaching right at me. Was he? I think so. Probably so. Probably so. Let's pray. Father, I know that in my life, and surely I'm not unique, but there have been way too many times that I have convinced myself that evil and wickedness is not as bad as it seems. It's something that I can presume upon you to be merciful. It's something that I can convince myself there will be no payday. Somehow at the same time, even having those same thoughts, I believe at the same time that what Zophar is saying is right as a general rule. Someday the price will be paid. God, help us, first of all, God, to learn just to control our mouth, to not have to say everything that comes to our mind, to not have to reveal our whole heart. God, to be compassionate. But Father, as much or even more, God, help us, Lord, just to live honorably. God, to make decisions that are right. Lord, to be committed in our lives, God, to doing righteous things. Help us learn from this book. Amen.